This is Smarter Care Connections, a podcast produced by the Virginia Center for Health Innovation. Smarter Care Connections features conversations with faculty from the Smarter Care Virginia Low-Value Healthcare Reduction Initiative, as well as other thought leaders and partners of the center. These conversations are intended to be informative, but easily digestible by healthcare professionals and policymakers interested in improving healthcare value. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Beth Fortz, President and CEO of the Virginia Center for Health Innovation, and welcome to our next edition of Smarter Care Connections. On today's podcast, I am delighted to have a fellow member of the National Task Force on Low-Value Care, Dr. John Keats, join me. John is the National Medical Director for Affordability and Specialty Partnerships at Cigna. John, we are so excited that you are here. You're, you know, working in the same space that we are, just with a different lens. And so to start, if I could, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your professional title. It's distinctive, if not unique, really, in the field. National Medical Director for Affordability and Specialty Partnerships. Can you give me a little background as to why Cigna decided to define this type of role within its leadership?
Great. Well, first of all, let me say, Beth, I'm also delighted to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation, and I look forward to our conversation. Yes, Cigna actually created this role about 5 years ago. I'm actually the first person at Cigna to have this title, and it's in recognition of a corporate direction that Cigna took around that time that had basically three goals, which was to make healthcare for our clients and customers affordable, predictable, and simple. And I was pleased that affordable was listed first, that that's the primary goal, recognizing that that the trajectory that healthcare was taking in our country in terms of the percentage of gross domestic product that's devoted to healthcare is essentially unaffordable at some point, and that we really have an obligation as good stewards of the healthcare dollars that are being spent by the people that depend on us really deserves a lot of attention, and that's why this role was created. In addition, we want to be the partner of choice for not only, and let me define these terms in Cigna speak, clients are the employers who look to Cigna for coverage for healthcare for their employees. So their employees are our customers. Certainly as a physician, I would think of them as patients, but when I'm wearing my hat as an executive at Cigna, they're customers. And then physicians, some don't like this term, but we generally refer to them as providers. And that can be physicians, but it can also be hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers, anyone who actually provides healthcare to patients. So we want to be the partner of choice for all of those groups, for customers, clients, and providers. And so part of that is to develop a collaborative and cooperative role with representatives of various specialties, these specialty societies. So I think certainly at least that part of my role is unique in talking to specialty societies. I'm not sure there's really any other major healthcare company right now that is focusing on that aspect, and I'm happy that Cigna has chosen to do so.
Well, thank you. And, you know, when we talk about defining, which you just did several terms very nicely for us, one of the things as a practical manner in our conversation, we both are working to reduce low value care, but it would help me. How does Cigna go about defining and identifying low value care?
Well, in general, low value care is care that doesn't contribute to the health or well-being of an individual and is frankly often potentially harmful. When we think of it in those terms, it's really fulfilling what is in fact Cigna's corporate mission, which says our mission is to improve the health, well-being, and peace of mind of the people we serve. So it fits very well in that way. But it really is not so simple. There is things that physicians can order that in one circumstance are very appropriate and very helpful. We want women to get pap smears. We want people over a certain age to get colonoscopies. So in the appropriate settings, that's high value care. But then when you turn around and perhaps do pap smears every year, which the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says isn't necessary, or you want to do colonoscopies on your patients more frequently than is recommended, that then becomes low value care. So there's this concept that's a little hard to understand, which I know you're very familiar with, Beth, because we've attended a lot of the same meetings, called clinical nuance. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very careful in how you define low value care. There is this concept of clinical nuance. But the good news is there are a couple of organizations that have provided a roadmap for us that we try to follow. One is the Institute of Medicine with their Choosing Wisely program, where these specialist societies that we've talked about have all contributed lists of actions, including procedures, diagnostic testing, et cetera, that they advise their members in general not to do. That's how these recommendations are phrased in Choosing Wisely. So you can look to Choosing Wisely for examples of low-value care. And there's something called the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force that puts out recommendations on testing and procedures, and they have a letter grading. So if something is graded D, that means it's not recommended and actually potentially harmful. So again, if you look to the list of things that the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force has graded letter D, again, that can be a roadmap to what could be considered low-value care. So we make use of those things as well.
So when we think about this, and you mentioned clinical nuance, and which is, you know, a key behind our work, one of the things that we've seen is even with the Choosing Wisely campaign, which is, you know, now more than 5 years old, you know, it's still we're not making great progress yet at changing clinician behavior, you know, and in order to reduce low value care, because it's not just cut and dry that a certain test or procedure is bad all the time, it really is about decision making. So, you know, what do you see from your vantage point as the biggest challenges in getting physicians to change their behavior, and what strategies might health plans in particular use to help foster some of that physician change?
That's a great question. I think there's at least a two-part answer. So one part is educational. We have to make sure that physicians and others are aware of these recommendations, whether it's through Choosing Wisely, through their own professional societies, actually, as reflected in Choosing Wisely, as some of the publications that these professional societies put out, aware of the USPSTF Category D recommendations. So it's an educational piece, and certainly an organization like Cigna has a role in that, in terms of the communications we put out to our contracted providers. We have newsletters. These things obviously in 2021 are done predominantly electronically, but we have newsletters and other communications that we put out to our providers where we try to communicate to them some of these aspects. And a lot of this shows up in our coverage policies. We have a very large and dedicated group, mostly nurses, who do the research that goes into our coverage policies, and they try to incorporate as quickly as possible any changes that are reflected in the medical literature, so that when these policies, which are typically reviewed on an 18 to 24 month cycle, are updated, we try to communicate that out to our contracted physicians as well. So an educational piece. These coverage policies are public record. You don't even have to be a contracted Cigna physician to see what our coverage policies are. You can go on the internet and they're all available, as do our competitors. The other piece, though, is a financial alignment piece. And I think as a health services company, we have an obligation to try to prevent some of the misalignment that sometimes leads to the utilization of low-value care. We need to design insurance products, benefit packages, and contractual language for our contracted providers that allows us to incentivize high-value care while at the same time trying to discourage the provision of low-value care. So it's education and financial alignment.
Well, would you talk a little bit, and I'm jumping off our script here a little bit, but you know, I know Cigna has done some pretty groundbreaking work around vitamin D screening. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Right. Well, that's, I think, just, you know, one example of the work that we do, but it was recognized several years ago, actually, already, because the timeline to make these changes sometimes is a little longer than probably either of us would like to see. But there were changes made in the recommendations for vitamin D screening. Most of this came out of the Endocrine Society, which is the professional society of medical endocrinologists, saying, hey, we're doing way too much testing of vitamin D in the population. It had reached a point due to some studies that were really more part of the popular press rather than strictly scientific literature that prompted a lot of blanket screening of entire populations of people for vitamin D deficiency, that the Endocrine Society finally came out and said, look, it's not really necessary. There are certain groups of people, this is where the clinical nuance comes in. Certainly there are groups of people, pregnant women, for example, the elderly, there are groups of people who should be tested for vitamin D deficiency. No one argues that. But it's not something that has to be done on a regular basis to an otherwise healthy average adult, let's say, who's not a senior citizen. So this information had been out there for some time, but Cigna had not taken any action to try to discourage this overuse of vitamin D deficiency testing. And so when we looked at it, we realized it was in the millions of dollars a year that was being spent on unnecessary testing, you know, separate out the patients for whom it was reasonable to do. And so through our process of evaluating our coverage policies, as I mentioned before, this coverage policy unit, it was determined that what we should do is change our policy so that we ceased paying for vitamin D testing in populations where it was not indicated. And you know, when I say it that way, it doesn't sound like it's really, to my ear, such a groundbreaking move. But in fact, it really was. We were the first healthcare company to really take that kind of step. And it saved our customers and clients literally millions of dollars a year in avoidance of unnecessary testing. So it's a process to get those kinds of things in place. We first have to recognize that the recommendations of specialty societies or the evidence has changed, incorporate that into our coverage policies, inform providers and clients and customers that we're gonna make this change, and then finally put it in place. So it's a process, but we did it. And now I would have to say, I think most, if not all, of our competitors have followed suit because it's clearly the right thing to do. It was based on evidence and it was based on recommendations from a well-recognized specialty society.
Well, I will say from our vantage point, we are appreciative that you have done that. And, you know, that's one of the tests and procedures in Virginia, of course, that we've brought some attention to. And so we're, you know, delighted when, you know, our health plan partners are tackling some of the same challenges that we are. Switching gears a little bit from the clinician perspective to the patient perspective and thinking about, you know, sometimes patients may resist avoiding low value care they sometimes people think, you know, more is always better, essentially. And so they might see taking, you know, something away, even if it's unnecessary or potentially harmful, as, you know, reducing access. And so what strategies has Cigna thought about or is using to engage its members as partners in reducing low value care? And from that, I'm talking about the patient, or I think you said, the customer perspective.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, some of this is seems sometimes is uniquely American, that we think more is better, and particularly it's I think somewhat uniquely American to think that, well, if something costs more, it must be better. And that's, you know, clearly when it comes to healthcare, not necessarily the case. So I think really the answer, even though you're directing it now to a different group, is very similar to what we already spoke about with the physicians. You have to educate people. People have to understand that there, first of all, is such a thing as low value care, that what it is, and that they have choices, and that people can be educated consumers. And many people bristle at trying to draw an analogy between receiving healthcare or trying to get value from healthcare to a consumer product, like buying a car. You know, people say, well, buying a car is like going to the doctor. No, it's not, except sometimes it is. Mm-hmm. And you probably wouldn't go shopping for a car without doing a little research first into, you know, what kind of car you might want to get or what constitutes value in an automobile, et cetera. It's the same thing with healthcare. We just want our customers, our patients to be informed and to be able to ask the right questions so that they're receiving appropriate care and receiving value for their healthcare dollars. So we engage our clients, the employers, to help us in this attempt to try to educate their own employees as to what might constitute low value care and to avoid that if possible. And then again, if we design our benefits properly, it will incentivize customers, incentivize patients to seek out high value care and avoid low value care. Another aspect of that, though, is something that Cigna is very interested in also, is this concept of whole person health. And one area that I think has been neglected to some degree is the intersection between behavioral health and physical health and financial well-being. And certainly what we are trying to do at Cigna is to, again, inform our clients and customers that these other aspects of well-being should not be neglected. And we're trying to make it easier for customers who have particularly chronic illnesses, for whom behavioral issues are very, very common, but often unrecognized and untreated, to get appropriate care. So we're trying to incorporate that type of education as well.
I think that's really insightful. You know, we in Virginia are learning a little bit. I think Washington State might have been the first that, you know, in their first do no harm report, they actually cited financial harm as, you know, a type of harm that could be done. And so, you know, that was a intriguing concept for us to add when we are thinking about unnecessary care and the potential harm to the patient. I think closing, you know, we've kind of talked through the different populations, but I'll come home to, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I remember in my years working at the Medical Society, somebody said to me, you know, 1/6 of the U.S. economy, you know, is the prescription pad and pen that a clinician has. And so when we talk about where we can really make change, you know, what advice would you give to the physician leaders? Because a lot of this is very clinician driven in their decision making. So what would you recommend to them?
So it's funny, Beth, you paraphrased something that I learned relatively early in my training, and the way it was taught to me was, what is the most expensive medical device in the United States? And then the person, say, would reach into their pocket and say, here's the most expensive medical device in this country, my pen, which is, of course, back in the days. I suppose now it's your index finger, if you're a one-finger typer, pushing buttons on your electronic medical record, or your wrist if you're moving your mouse around. But I'm old enough that I remember when we used to use something called pen and paper.
Right.
I don't know if anyone remembers that anymore. But that used to be the joke, was the physician's pen is the most expensive medical device in the country. So for me, the word for physician leaders is to make the physicians that you are leading aware of the cost of care. This has to start with training programs. It needs to start in medical school. It needs to start in residency. I mean, it's a cliche now that physicians are not taught this. Certainly that never came up in my training 100 years ago. But I think it is slowly seeping into medical education, but it's making physicians aware to have transparency. For me, that's the big thing, particularly when you're dealing with a group of physicians. It's not to be afraid to put out there what the cost of care is for each of the physicians and let each physician know what the other physician is doing. First of all, physicians are competitive by nature. I think it's because of the way we select for medical schools. That's a whole nother topic. We'll do another podcast on that at some point, I hope, Beth. But the way we choose candidates for medical school, these are people who tend to be competitive to begin with, and that continues on into their careers. So physicians don't like to be seen as outliers with each other. So transparency, education of cost awareness, peer pressure is the best way really to change physician behavior. That's pretty clear. And then the sense of shared responsibility, the sense of stewardship, that we all have a responsibility to make sure that the precious dollars that are spent on healthcare in this country, both by our government, Medicare and Medicaid, by companies like Cigna and others, by all the employers, because we still have mostly employee-based insurance in this country, and the patients themselves, who often have a financial burden to bear. You know, healthcare costs is the leading cause of bankruptcy in this country, that we all have our shared responsibility to make sure that those precious healthcare dollars are spent wisely. And that's something that we at Cigna take very seriously.
Well, folks, I think you can see why we consider Dr. Keats a kindred spirit here. I mean, you know, when he talks about sharing information with the physician community, that's exactly what we're doing in Smarter Care with our, you know, quarterly reports from the APCD, where folks get to see, you know, how they are doing and compare themselves with others in their practice and within their system and the state. But, you know, I want to close with, you know, we also recognize, and I think Dr. Keats would agree with me that it's also learning and asking a lot of questions about why that variation exists, and never assuming that when we look at the data on the first run that we know, because we have learned a lot from our, you know, clinician partners who help us realize sometimes why there are legitimate differences in the data, and then sometimes where some behaviors need to change. And so, you know, physicians are competitive, and they also really, when they see their own data, they want to do better. They want to be the best at providing excellent, high value care. And so, you know, I couldn't have teed that up any nicer. You did a fabulous job. And I just want to say, you know, thank you and thank Cigna for, you know, for making this an important issue in your work. And it ties so nicely with ours. And we really look forward to continuing to work with you to improve value in healthcare in the Commonwealth of Virginia and in the country.
We very much agree. We want to do the same. So again, thank you so much for this opportunity, Beth. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Smarter Care Connections.